What might you lose with all this gaining? Thank you, Minyao, for the lights. You can all see me now. What might you lose with all this gaining? This was a question that Bob Buford asked himself right around the time he was turning 40. Bob Buford was one of the forerunners in the television and cable industry. He was the CEO of a large entertainment company, and he and his company were sort of on the forefront in the kind of 50s through 80s of the television industry and the cable industry. And he made a lot of money doing this. He was really successful. And as a result of this, he sort of had more than he ever thought he might get out of life, more than he ever thought he might get out of his career. But right around the time he turned 40, he started asking himself this question: what might you lose with all this gaining? He was looking around at all that he had accomplished, all that he had gained through his work and the hard work that he had put in and the education that he had received and all the time that he had spent and the sacrifices that he had made and the success that he had found in his work. And he started realizing right around the age of 40 that there were actually some downsides to this, some cost in other areas of his life. So a few years after he kind of started thinking about this and had this realization, he came down with what he describes as success panic. And this is what he said about success panic. He said, he's describing this moment in which this sort of happened to him. He says, "Success panic passed through the threshold of my door when I was 44. It hit me with a blunt object, my slavish devotion to the art of the deal and the thrill of the kill. How much was enough? By this time, the television industry had grown beyond our most optimistic projections. As a result, I had long since arrived at and in fact surpassed the goals that I had established for wealth accumulation. I had a big house, I had the Jaguar, I could and I did travel to whatever place I wished. I had either reached or was ahead of the plan to meet most of the rest of my goals as well. Panic success was wholly unexpected." And what he goes on to say to describe this panic success is he gives this story about two men who climbed Mount Everest. And in the months and the years leading up to this, and on the climb on the way up, all they were focused on, all they could think about was getting to the top and what that was going to be like, the view that they would have from the top. And then when they got to the top, within a few minutes, all they could think about was how to get down. And they weren't so concerned about being at the top anymore. They realized, I haven't thought about what to do from here. And this is what Buford describes as panic success. This, he had set all these goals for himself in his career and in how much money he was going to be making and the progress that he was going to make. He had set all these goals, and by the time he was 44, he realized that he had met or surpassed virtually all of these goals and had no real concept, no real thought of what he was supposed to be, what he was supposed to be doing from that point on. Most of us in this room are not at that point yet. We're not quite there. But that's why we want to take some time tonight to think about what do we need to do to make sure we don't get to where Bob Buford was, where we get to our middle age and we've set all these goals in our career and we realize that we've met them, we've exceeded them, but now we don't really know what to do from there. So most of us here are at the beginning of our careers, and we're learning, and we're training, and we're looking for the next opportunity that's going to help us advance, and we're setting those goals now. We're looking for things that will grow us, things that will stretch us, and maybe we've started to meet some of those goals. Maybe we've achieved a certain amount that we wanted to achieve, either in the amount of money that we have or the degrees that we have or the level that we sit in our companies. Maybe we've achieved some of these things. But what we want to think about tonight in part is how do we make sure that we avoid success panic? How do we make sure that we don't end up in the same spot that Bob Buford did. And the reason that we're thinking about this here in the Young Adult Fellowship at PBC is because we are going through this series called Adulting, Thinking Responsibly About Work, Money, and Relationships. And for the past three or four weeks, we've been thinking about the topic of work. What does it mean to approach our work as Christians? What does it mean to approach our work, to let our faith impact our work as followers of Christ? And so we're going to continue thinking about that tonight. But what I want to look at tonight specifically, and this is going to help us to avoid that mistake that Bob Buford made, is we want to think about the motivations behind why we work. In this area in particular, as people have asked me questions or talked with me about sort of how to be a Christian at work, how to integrate faith and work, one of the most common questions is, how do I balance work with the rest of life? How do I make sure that, and that usually means, how do I make sure I'm not working too much? Not how do I make sure I'm not working enough. Some people do have that problem, but for a lot of people in this area, it's, how do I make sure I'm not working too much? And this is the predicament that Bob Buford had found himself in. For the first 20 years of his career, he had worked and he had worked and he had worked. And by the time he got to middle age, he realized that there was some adverse consequences to that in the rest of life. So we want to think about, how do we manage a work-life balance? But the way that we're going to come at that question tonight is by thinking about our motivations for work. Why do we work? Why do we do our jobs? What are the reasons that we're doing what we're doing, the reasons that we're putting in the amount of time, the amount of effort, why are we doing it the way that we're doing it? Those are the questions that we want to look at tonight. Because what we're going to see is that if we can look at our motivations for work, why is it that we do the things we do when it comes to work, then that's going, if we can start off on a solid footing there, if we can have the right motivations, then I think what we find is that this question of work-life balance gets a little bit easier. That problem sort of takes care of itself if we can take a step back and think about our motivations for work. So that's what we want to do tonight, is look at our motivations for work. Why do we work? And the best way to do that, or the path that we're going to take tonight, is to think about some unhealthy ways to approach work, some unhealthy motivations or reasons why we work and why we do it the way that we do or how much of it we do, and then look at what ought our reasons to be, what ought our motivations to be when it comes to our jobs. So, I want to hear from you guys. What are some possible motivations, good or bad, for why we work? Right? Why do you get up in the morning and go to work? Or maybe why did you choose your specific kind of work? Or when you think about your motivations for work, what are some possible motivations, or maybe your motivations in particular?
Money.
Money. Yeah, a paycheck. That's big. I'm guessing that everybody probably has that as a motivation somewhere along the way for why you're working. Money. Yeah. What else? What could other reasons be?
To look better than your peers.
To look better than your peers. Yeah. So maybe you apply for a certain job or go into a certain field or work as hard as you do at your job because you want to look better than the people around you. That could be a reason. What else?
Approval from people in your company.
Okay. Approval from people within our company. So we've got people evaluating what we're doing, and we want them to think well of us, so that's going to impact how we do what we do and why we do it. What else? Anything else come to mind?
Independence.
Independence?
You don't have to either mooch off the government or your family.
Okay, right. Yeah, so not just money, strictly speaking, but some of the things that money affords us, one of those being independence, the ability to do what we want, to go where we want, to buy what we want, not to be dependent on other people for those things. Great. What else?
Maybe you want to grow in a certain area.
Okay.
In a certain way.
Okay, yeah. So you want to get to a certain spot, and you know that the way that you approach your job or your work is going to help you get to where you want to be. That's good. Anything else?
Better the world.
Better the world.
Healthcare, for instance.
Okay. Yes, so perhaps just in theory you are in the healthcare industry in some way, shape, or form. Part of your motivation might be to help the world. Yeah, make the world a better place. Anything else come to mind for people?
Self-fulfillment.
Self-fulfillment? Say more about that. How might work help you achieve self-fulfillment?
Kind of what Mignon said, with like approval, but like approval from yourself.
Yeah. Okay, so not just what do other people think of you, but what do you think of yourself? When you sort of wake up and look at yourself in the mirror in the morning, what do you think about yourself? How does your work impact that? Yeah. Anyone else want to throw something out?
You could be bored if you don't.
You could be bored, yeah. So it's something to occupy your time. Yeah, what are you going to do if you don't work? Well, I don't know. So let's go work. That could be a reason. So with all of these things, I shouldn't say all. I didn't write them all down. I'm looking at them. But with most of these things, at least, these could be proper motivations or they could be unhealthy motivations. There's aspects of all of these things that we probably all experience to some degree or another. And there are times when these motivations are going to be helpful in the right proportion, and there are times when these motivations might be unhelpful. And I think one thing that a lot of people are concerned about, and as well we should be concerned about, is are we making an idol out of our work? Are we looking at our jobs or our work and we're placing it up on a pedestal and we are worshiping it in the way that we approach it? We're giving it all of our effort, all of our attention, all of our affection maybe, and we're sort of pouring everything we have into our jobs. What I want to suggest tonight, though, is that in a sense, work can be an idol, but I think it's actually more helpful to think about the various motivations that we have for work and the way that work reveals our idols. So I think work is a major part of our lives. It's something that we all experience and we all interact with and we all think about. And because of that, because it's such a big portion of life, it's a big thing in our life, it's sort of opens us up to a bunch of stuff that's going on under the surface. And what we're going to see is that the way that we approach our work actually reveals some of our idols more than the work itself. So in one sense, I think work could be an idol. It could be something that we give ourselves to in an undue manner. But for the most part, it's the reasons why we do that that we ought to be concerned with. Because if we can sort those things out, then we're going to be able to keep work itself from becoming an idol. And part of that is maintaining this kind of work-life balance, kind of having the appropriate amount of time and energy going to work and going to other things that are important, like friends and family and church and ministry and volunteering and things like that. So what I want to do is there are plenty of unhealthy motivations that we could focus on, but I just want to identify three of them that I think are some of the major and most common unhealthy motivations for work, and then go ahead and look at what ought our motivations to be and how does that impact the way that we work. So first off, and these are kind of categories of things that can loop together a lot of what you guys said. So one unhealthy motivation for work is comfort. And I didn't say money because pursuing comfort is more than just pursuing money. Usually if you're pursuing comfort, you are pursuing money because you want the things that you can buy with money so that your life is a certain way. But pursuing comfort could also be about pursuing a life of leisure in which you're actually not working as hard as you should be. Or you're being lazy or slothful in some way. Because you are valuing comfort more than you're valuing the work. But that could take a different form, and for you, comfort has sort of a certain definition, a certain picture. If life were to be comfortable, it would look this way, and in order to get life to be that way, I need a certain amount of money, so I'm actually going to work really, really hard so that I can have enough money to buy the things that I want to or do the things that I want to that are going to make me comfortable. So when we think about pursuing comfort in our work or comfort as a motivation for work, that's something that could either lead us to work too much or it could lead us to work not enough. But the thing about comfort, the thing about money in particular, is that as we pursue money, or if we make money our motivation, because it's not bad to work and get a paycheck, right? That's a good thing. We ought to be bringing home a paycheck from our work. But if money is the motivation, or the things that money can buy are the motivation for our work, that's when we're going to run into problems. And Jesus helps us understand why that is in Matthew 6. So Matthew 6, this is just after Jesus has talked about don't store up treasures on earth, but store up treasures in heaven, for where your treasure is, there your heart will be also, he says. And then he says, no one can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and money. So what he's trying to say there is that we can't have our motivation be both God and money. Because something interesting happens when we start to make money our motivation, or when we start to serve money, is that it becomes our master. We become enslaved to it. And we see that played out in a few different ways, but one of the ways Jesus starts talking about right after. And if you look in your Bible, this section would actually be broken into two different paragraphs, probably with a subheading, showing like, okay, now we're talking about something different. But really, Jesus isn't talking about anything different. Really, he's still talking about the same thing. So he says you can't serve both God and money because you can't have two masters, and money is going to master you if you serve it. Then he says, therefore I tell you, do not be anxious about your life, what you'll eat or what you will drink, nor about your body, what you will put on. Is not life more than food and the body more than clothing? So he's making this connection between anxiety and money. And the reason he's doing that is because what happens if you serve money? What happens if you are mastered by money? Well, let's say that you have a certain amount in mind that you need to make in order to be happy. You need to make in order to be comfortable. Then you start making that amount. Are you happy? Maybe for a little bit. Maybe for a day or two or a year maybe. But pretty soon, that's not enough, right? And now there's something that's, if you just had a little bit more money, then you could buy that thing, or you could do that thing, or you could go to that place. And then you get to there, and then just a little bit farther, and just a little bit farther, and it's always out of reach. This is what Jesus means by money being our master. It starts to take control of us. And the result of that, one of the results, is that we become anxious. We're driven by our anxiety, because we see these things that are just out of sight, and we want to pursue them. We want to get them. We're worried that we won't have what we need or probably what we want. So then we start to work harder and harder to make more money and more money so that we can always get that thing that's just out of grasp. I started to feel this a little bit this year after Christmas because I got some money for Christmas and I was like, oh great, I've got some cash to spend. So I started thinking about the things that I might want to buy. And I made a list and it's like, okay, I could buy this, or I could buy this, or I could buy this. I could buy these three things. And pretty soon my list was pretty long. And the amount of money that I had was nowhere near enough to buy all of these things that I wanted to buy. And now I'm feeling discouraged, right? I got this money for Christmas and I'm like, oh, this sucks. Like, I can't buy anything. But the interesting thing is that before I got that money, I wasn't disappointed about not having those things. But now I have this money and now all of a sudden, instead of just being thankful that I can buy one thing, I'm disappointed that I can't buy all of these other things. And money, for at least a brief while, it started to master me. I was experiencing a bit of this, and I was like, no, you can't think that way. So if we work primarily because we want to make a certain amount of money, we start to become mastered. We start to fall into this trap where we never have quite enough. We always just have to work a little bit harder or get a job that pays a little bit more so that we can buy that little bit nicer thing, and we never get to the end. So you can see that if we pursue money, if we let money be our primary motivation for why we work, doesn't mean it can't be a motivation. It is a motivation in why I work, It's not the only reason I'm here tonight, but it's part of it, right? I need to provide for my family, and I need to eat, but it's not my main reason. So, we don't want to pursue comfort, because if we pursue comfort, that is going to lead us to a spot in work and in life where we're unfulfilled and we're exhausted, because we're always trying to work a little bit harder to make a little bit more. A second unhealthy motivation for money is success or achievement. This is where we have goals. This is the trap that Bob Buford fell into. He set all of these goals, and if I could only just reach this goal, right? Whatever it is for you in your career, I'm sure you have goals, and goals are good. But where we go wrong is when we say, okay, if I could just get to this point, right? If I could just have this kind of degree, or if I could just be at this level in my company, or if I could learn these set of skills so I could get this kind of job, and we set these goals, and then 5 years from now I want to be here, and 10 years from now I want to be here, so that 20 years I can be here, so I can achieve these kind of goals. This too, like the pursuit of money, becomes a never-ending cycle. Because we set a goal, but once we achieve it, we're not happy there. It's like climbing Mount Everest. You climb it, and it's like, okay, but what now? Where do I go from here? Mary Bell is a counselor who works with a lot of high-level executives in companies. And she has noticed this trend in these sort of high-level executives. And the observation that she makes is that there maybe was once a time where the addiction of wealthy people was alcohol, right? They would that was sort of a common addiction among the wealthy or the successful. But what she says is that achievement is the alcohol of our time. She goes on to say, these days people don't abuse alcohol; they abuse their lives. You complete a project and you feel like dynamite, but that doesn't last for long, and you slide back to normal. And then she describes this cycle that you get into, where you set a goal and you meet it. And when you meet that career goal, you feel great, you feel on top of the world. But a week later, or a month later, you feel just like you did before. And you set a new goal. And then when you achieve that goal, you get that same kind of high. But then that fades. And the high, even though the job is better and you're making more money, the high actually wasn't quite as high as it was before. So you set a new goal, if I could just get to here, and then you climb to that goal and you meet it and you experience some of that high, but the high is even a little bit less than the previous time, and it lasts for a shorter amount of time. And we end up getting caught in this cycle of achievement, of self-fulfillment, self-realization. We're trying to get someplace, but every time we get there, we realize that that wasn't sufficient, that we want to go somewhere else, that we want to do something else. So if success or achievement is our motivation for work, what ends up happening is that as we start to place our self-worth in the achievements that we have had at work, in the things that we have been able to accomplish in our jobs, we start to place our self-worth in those things, and then if we ever don't get to our next step, we feel terrible about ourselves. But if we do get there, if we do achieve it, then we just go ahead and set a new goal, and now again, we feel terrible about ourselves because we're not where we think we should be. We don't view ourselves in those situations as God views us. We start to view ourselves, we start to understand our worth as a product of what we've accomplished in our work or just in life in general. So if we approach our work with success or achievement as our primary goal, then that too is going to lead us to a place of frustration, of feeling unfulfilled, and probably of feeling exhausted, because we're going to be working so hard and yet never quite getting to where we want to be. The third unhealthy motivation that we might have for our work is recognition. And this again is sort of a collection of things, but if achievement or success is kind of about where we can get and how we feel about ourselves, recognition is about what other people think about us. It's about what our coworkers think, or about our neighbors think, or what about what our parents think about us. We want a certain kind of recognition. And we see this play out in one of the early chapters of the Bible. In Genesis 11, we have the story of Babel. And this is a great sort of picture into the way that mankind has gone wrong when it comes to our work, and specifically what happens when recognition becomes our motivation for why we work. So let's look at this in Genesis 11, 1-4. It says, "Now the whole earth had one language and the same words. And as people migrated from the east, they found a plain in the land of Shinar and settled there. Then they said to one another, 'Come, let us make bricks and burn them thoroughly.'" So let's just back up a minute from there. We've looked at Genesis 1 through 3 so far. What we've seen in those chapters is that part of the responsibility of humans is to work, that we're created with work in mind, and that work means to be creators and cultivators of God's creation. So that's actually what we see them doing here. They're trying to cultivate. They're taking some raw materials, they're making them into bricks to go and to build something. So far, so good. So picking up in the middle of verse 3 there, "And they had brick for stone and bitumen for mortar. Then they said, 'Come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower with its top in the heavens, and let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be dispersed over the face of the whole earth.'" So they come together, they start to create and to cultivate, to make bricks and to build things, but right from the start, we see that their motivation is that they would make a name for themselves. That when people look at this thing that they're building, they would go, "Wow, how amazing that is, and how amazing those people must be who have built this thing, who have accomplished this thing, who have done this marvelous work." So part of what's going on here is that these people had the wrong motivations for their work. They were working, but they had the completely wrong set of motivations. They were looking for recognition. It's also likely that this thing that they were building was something of a temple, and it was not a temple to God. It was some sort of other religious building. So given that, and given their motivation of trying to make a name for themselves, God decides to disperse them all around the world by giving them different languages so that they couldn't communicate with each other in order to continue this work that they had set out to do. So God says, no. If that's your motivation for work, that's not going to work with me. That ought not be your motivation. That is only going to bring you to places that you don't want to be. But it's easy for us to fall into this trap. Right? It's easy to fall into the trap of working so that we would receive recognition, so that people would think well of us. And so we want to get to a certain point so that people are impressed. And I have to admit, even that for me, something I have to wrestle with, something I have to struggle with, is part of my job is standing up in front of people and talking every week. And when you do that, people tend to evaluate you. So I always have to be fighting this tendency to want positive recognition, right? Because it's not just recognition that we want, it's positive recognition. So I always have to be fighting when I'm preparing to preach and when I am preaching, that my motivation is not recognition. That I'm not mostly concerned about what you guys think about me. That I'm not mostly concerned about what other pastors on staff think about me or what anybody thinks about me. But that I'm most worried about what God thinks. And what am I accomplishing through my work? And the same thing is true for all of us in our work. Whether you're up in front of somebody talking, whether your work is something that is not highly visible, whatever it is, we have a tendency, we're just drawn to pursue recognition, for people to think well of us because of what we do. But just like we've seen with success, just like we've seen with comfort, if that is our driving motivation for why we work as hard as we do, for why we do what we do at work, for how we work, if that's our driving motivation, that too is going to leave us exhausted and unfulfilled, because that is not the mindset that we're supposed to approach our work with. So what then is the mindset that we're supposed to have? What should our motivations be as we think about our jobs? And as we think about what does it mean to be a follower of Jesus and to be doing whatever I happen to do for work? What are the proper motivations for our work? And what I want to suggest is going to sound probably very simple, but it's because it is simple, and this is supposed to be our motivation. If it can become our motivation, then we're going to be able to find that fulfillment and that rest, and we're not going to be driven to a place of either working too much or not working enough as we approach our jobs. So the motivations that we are supposed to have for approaching our work are twofold. The first is to love God, and the second is to love our neighbor. That might sound familiar because that's what Jesus tells us to do. When he's asked the question, teacher, what is the greatest commandment in the law? So somebody comes to him and wants Jesus to answer this question, referring back to the Old Testament. There's all these commandments there. Jesus, which one is the greatest? And Jesus says, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind. This is the great and first commandment, and the second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments depend all the law and the prophets. The law and the prophets being the Old Testament. The Old Testament including Genesis, what we've looked at so far, that we're created to work, that we've rebelled against God, and because of that, the world doesn't work as it should be, and our work has suffered the consequences of that as well. It's hard. It's unfulfilling. We don't always like doing it. There's all these roadblocks in the way to experiencing that fulfillment that we're supposed to in our jobs. So what Jesus is saying here is that on these two commandments, love God and love your neighbor, everything that's in the Old Testament hangs on that, including what it says about work. So if we want to know how is it that we're supposed to approach our jobs, we're supposed to do it first out of love for God, and second, out of love for our neighbor, for our fellow humans, for our brothers and sisters. So what would that look like? What does it look like to approach your job as a way of loving God? Well, one of the ways that Paul spells out for us in Colossians is he says, whatever you do, work heartily, as for the Lord and not for men, knowing that from the Lord you will receive the inheritance as your reward. You are serving the Lord Christ. So part of what he says is as you go to work, you most likely have a boss. You have somebody that you're reporting to, and they have certain expectations of you, and they have certain requirements of you, and it can be really easy to get caught up in all of these things that they are asking you to do. But what Paul says is when you go to work, when you do your job, work hard at it, work really hard, do your best, because ultimately, you're not serving your boss. Yes, you are serving your boss. Yes, you are doing what your boss asks. But there's a way that you can do that that is really a way of serving the Lord. Because we recognize that we were created by God to work. So therefore, when we work, we are ultimately being obedient to God. So hopefully, we are also doing the things that our supervisors ask us to do. But ultimately, our work is an expression of faithfulness to God because this is what he has created us to do. What else might it look like to approach our work as a way of loving God? Well, some of the things we've touched on in the last couple weeks, so I'm not going to expand on them a lot now, but not only are we supposed to work hard because we're working for the Lord, but we are supposed to have certain ethical standards as we approach our work. Right? We're not supposed to cheat the system. We're not supposed to fudge reports and lie on things. And we're supposed to have kind of an ethical standard as we approach our jobs. That's going to be part of what it looks like. And also, we're going to do work that the Lord approves of. The kind of jobs that we do, the goods and the services that we are producing as a part of our jobs, we want those things to be things that the Lord would approve of, that are benefiting the world in some way, that are benefiting society and are not hurting it. So that's That's part of what it means to approach our work as a way of loving God. But I think that one of kind of the most tangible ways to do this is actually to do the second part of Jesus' commandment. That if we want to approach our work as a way of loving God, we need to think about our jobs as a way of loving our neighbor, of loving the people around us. And this can take many different forms. This has to do with how we treat our coworkers and our colleagues, the kind of attitude that we have at work. But it also has to do with what our work is, right? What is our work producing? And am I doing what I'm doing because I care about people and because what I'm doing is going to have an impact on people? Or am I doing what I'm doing for some other reason, for some selfish reason? So let's say that you are a physician. In that case, for you, if somebody was watching your office, your practice, they may or may not be able to discern why you do what you do, but there might be some signs. If you pack your schedule as absolutely tight as possible at the neglect of the quality of care that you're able to give people, that might be because what you're most concerned about is the amount of money that you're bringing home. And the more people that you see, the more people you get through in a day, the more money comes in. So you might really cram things tight at the expense of a few of your patients. They probably won't ever know. They won't know that you cut a few corners. They're not going to be able to tell. So I'm just going to, you know, take a little bit of a shortcut here. But if you approach that job as a way of loving your neighbor instead of pursuing money or comfort, then you're going to do what you can to put the care of the patient ahead of your bottom line. And being a doctor is sort of a very hands-on, you're interacting with patients. It's very evident the ways that you can love your neighbor in that job. A lot of our jobs, we're not interacting with people in that way. We have coworkers, we have colleagues, we have customers, but it's maybe not quite as hands-on as a doctor is with his patients. But there are still ways in which we can approach our work as a way of loving people. So, for example, if you are an engineer and you're designing a product, you could design it in such a way that your motivation for doing that is so that other people will see your work and they will be impressed by you. Or you can think about the end result of that product. Whatever it is, somebody's going to be using that product for something. And if you have that person in mind as you design your product, and you want to make it the best that you can because you want that person's experience of it to be good, or you want them to be able to get the maximum benefit from it, that might not actually look any different on the surface. You might actually do the same quality of work if you do it for the sake of the person on the receiving end versus if you do it for the sake of the recognition that you're going to get because of it. But what's going to be the difference at the end of the day in that scenario? The difference is going to be the way that you feel about your work. Because if at the end of the day, you can say, I know I did my best, and that's going to benefit this person, you leave content. And you leave ready to come back the next day and start the next project that's going to do something else good for somebody else who needs it. But if you approach it as a means of gaining recognition, then you fall into one of the traps that we looked at earlier. Yes, maybe you get some of that satisfaction for a while, but then that satisfaction fades. And you need to start a new project, not because you're concerned about somebody who's on the receiving end, but because now you need to experience that satisfaction again, and again, and again, and again, and again. And that drives us to a place where we end up exhausting ourselves, where we end up unfulfilled by the work that we're doing, instead of fulfilled like we're created to be. So that ultimately, loving God and loving our neighbor, is supposed to be our motivations for why we do what we do in all areas of life, but specifically when it comes to our work. So, on a very practical level, and if we're thinking about how can we be sure that we have a proper balance between work and the rest of life? Yes, if we have the right motivations, I do think that some of that is going to work itself out, that we're not going to be driven to overwork like we might if we have the wrong motivations. But there also are some practical things that you can do. And when I was in seminary, we had these events where we would bring in local pastors to speak to the seminary students. And they would come to chapel, and then we would do a lunch and a Q&A after. And one of the questions, invariably, no matter who the speaker was or what they had said, one of the questions that people would ask was, how do you maintain a work-life balance in ministry? That happened to be this specific context, but the answer could fit into any context. How do we make sure that we are actually doing this, that we're not working too much at the expense of other areas of life? And this one day, this particular pastor who was there was from the UK. And when he got asked this question, he just laughed. And he said, "You Americans are always so worried about measuring these things. Like, you're so worried about having these concrete ways that you can tell, okay, if you're doing this, you're not working too much. If you're doing this, you are working too much. If you're doing this, you're not working enough. You want all these ways to measure things." He goes, "Back home, I just ask my friends. I just have people that know me. And I just say, hey, how am I doing? Am I working too much? Am I spending enough time with my family? Am I loving my wife well? Am I loving my kids well?" And then his friends would just speak into it. So that would be my exhortation to us tonight, is to do two things. One, to stop and do some self-reflection, self-evaluation. How are we doing on this? What are our motivations? Are we working more than we need to or more than we should be because our motivations are wrong? But then also to talk to the people around us, to ask the people that know us, hey, how am I doing? How am I doing at this? Do you think I'm working too much? Do you think I'm not working enough? Do you think I'm loving my family well? Do you think I'm loving my friends well? Am I involved in church and ministry the way that I should be? Am I pursuing, giving enough time to my pursuit of the Lord? And we need to have people in our lives who can speak into that. So that's my encouragement tonight, that we would do some sort of self-reflection, and then we would help each other with that process as well. And we're going to have a chance in just a minute to start to do that in small groups, and hopefully we can continue to do that long after tonight as well. So before we do that, let me pray for us. Lord, I thank you that you have given us instruction in your word on how it is that we're supposed to approach our work, our jobs. And Lord, you have created us to be fulfilled by our work, to be satisfied by it, not to let it be the thing that defines us, but to be proud of what we do and to be thankful that we're able to contribute to society and to love you and to love our neighbors through what we're able to accomplish with our hands and with our minds and with our work. So Lord, I pray that you would help us, each of us, to reflect on how we're doing as we try to approach work with the right motivations, so that we don't give it too much emphasis or not enough emphasis, so that we can balance it well with the other things that you have called us to do responsibly in our lives. So we pray that, Holy Spirit, that you would give us insight into our lives, and that you might give us insight into our close friends as well. And we pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.